So I was just on an epic search for coffee, and apparently all the coffee in this building is out. So I apparently have some on delivery. So if I'm a little bit shaky until then, please forgive me. Good morning. I'm Nick Farr, and the topic of this talk is Future 3.0. Last year at SIGINT, I was asked to give a keynote, and I ended up, after consulting Twitter and friends, gave a talk on the future, which I called Future 42.0. It was 42 random data points on the future. And so since then, I've been kind of thinking about that, and instead of just throwing a bunch of things about the future that I've been thinking about, I decided, is there any way that I can organize these things a little bit better, try to apply some pattern analysis and look at things that way? And this is what I've come up with. Just sort of taking the analogy from user interfaces and from, you know, Web 1.0, Web 2.0, and then Web 3.0, whenever Tim O'Reilly decides to call it Web 3.0, I thought we could take this sort of looking at things and say that, yes, we can view any future progression, taking what we know from the past and the immediate present, and come up with a relatively reliable hypothesis on the future. And the next slide is hopefully not a too terribly complicated Venn diagram describing what I think the nature between 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. The first thing you'll notice is that there's a large correlation between the characteristics of things that I describe as 1.0 and 3.0, where 2.0 is the intermediate step. And I'm going to go into very specific examples about this, but just taking a moment to absorb this slide right here. 1.0 you can think of as anything from the ancient past to the very first beginnings of a technology. Things in 1.0 are crude. They tend to not be very scalable. They're early adopter sorts of things. They're characterized by generally low growth. But at the same time, they're very natural. They're decentralized, that you don't see a lot of centralization or concentration in these things. They're independent efforts. You can look at 1.0 as the beginning of the web or the beginning of domesticated agriculture, that these things are simple, we're just learning the processes, but it's natural, it's direct. It's something that we can think of and wrap our heads around very easily. 2.0 is an intermediate step. It's where a lot of things exist today. It's when we begin looking at things in terms of analogies, when we begin refining a lot of the things that we developed in 1.0, and when we start seeing really massive growth. The Industrial Revolution, for example, is a 2.0 phenomenon. The economic miracle in West Germany is a 2.0 phenomenon. What we're seeing with Ajax, Web 2.0, interactive technologies, the first time that this technology, which we have had for a while and has existed in a 1.0 state, has matured and grown into a 2.0 state. But the problem is that these things aren't very natural. They've evolved, they've become more massively adopted, but they're a little bit divorced from the natural phenomenon from which they came. 3.0, I argue, in a lot of things, is a return to the more natural ways of doing things. It's a return to decentralized sorts of interconnected networks of things and of processes and of technologies, and it's direct. It doesn't require a lot of learning or a lot of adaptation. You can just straight dive into it and you understand what it is, because the technologies have evolved in such a way that what we learned from 2.0 we're taking and making into something that's very easily adaptable. This is where a lot of barrier to entry sort of fall, and where we start focusing on things like sustainability, and at the same time start acknowledging the law of entropy and saying that 3.0 we can have ordered interconnected structures, but they don't need to be things that we absolutely control and have to centralize and have to manage. The growth in 2.0 has made the sorts of things in 3.0 and the ability to control 3.0 technologies much more difficult and much more abstract, but we acknowledge that and we live with it, and we can actually embrace that as a way of looking at technologies in the future. Have I lost you guys so far? Is it still okay? Okay, all right. And I'll keep referring back to this chart later on. Just beginning with technology, I'm gonna run through these examples as quickly as I can, and hopefully I'll have a little bit of time for questions and answers and try to foster discussion later on. Of course, when we're looking at 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, I took this directly from what we know about the web. What we know as now is Web 1.0, the first HTML standard, basic static web pages, a way of graphically displaying data and transferring it over the internet. Nothing too tremendous. I mean, the most complicated things we had in here were form submits, you know. Then as all of those technologies in 1.0 started to evolve, people started developing new standards, eventually we sort of arrive at a point where we're at Web 2.0, which I think can be classically sort of illustrated through asynchronous JavaScript. It's much more interactive, but at the same time, it's much more centralized. You see all of these sites attempting to concentrate power within them. You know, things like the search engine was always going to be a centralized sort of thing. Google is very dominant in the market. But entities like Flickr, entities like Twitter, entities like Facebook, these technologies that use these interactive technologies that have, that incorporate a lot of the things as part of Web 2.0 are big central data stores. You know, we all know about the fail whale. We all know about Facebook's privacy issues. And that this is a classic example of what I think of as the 2.0 centralization of things. Certain centers of gravity seek power. They provide an excellent service. They provide a very low barrier to entry for adoption of the technology. And a lot of these things, good or bad, drove the mass adoption of the web. It's not uncommon for our grandparents to look at photos of us from Facebook, for example. But going into the future, what will Web 3.0 look like? And here's where I'm sort of making the logical jump based on the pattern analysis of things that have happened in the past. Web 3.0 is going to be much more natural, much more interoperable, much more living in a more natural, organic system than the centralized Web 2.0. Instead of massively centralized social networks, Twitter, Facebook, we're going to see more things like Diaspora, which was an effort that was started by a bunch of students at New York University in response to a lot of the privacy threats presented by Facebook. Web 3.0 is going to be more direct. Just like Web 2.0 brought direct purchase of things like airline tickets, hotel reservations, eliminated the need for travel agents, middlemen for purchasing things, we're going to see that continued directness in 3.0, so that you are going to communicate directly with the person who is making that good or service that you're looking for. Efficiencies are going to be seen in that kind of direct communication. And things are going to be much more sustainable, just like the fail whale has showed us. Things like Twitter and Facebook are going to be are not completely sustainable models as they scale and as they grow. And things like cloud technologies, AWS, the things that are helping a lot of these services sort of stay afloat in the midst of centralization, are going to help bring many more disparate points along the web together. The ideal behind Web 2.0 or Web 3.0 is that it really is a true flattened web of much smaller entities working together in a much more organic structure like we see in the natural environment. And so just taking a quick look back at that graph, 1.0 HTML, one, it was crude, not very high growth patterns, but it was decentralized, natural, and direct. 2.0 was that intermediate step. More centralization, things but more refined, less direct, and huge growth. 3.0, we see that progression, that continued progression from 1.0 to 2.0 to 3.0, back into something that's much more direct, decentralized, natural, sustainable, and embracing the fact that systems, while still discrete, act and behave and are viewed and perceived as indiscrete systems. Taking this example and applying it more towards interfaces. 1.0, the command line. 2.0, WIMP. Most of the interfaces that we see today have been characterized and theorized as WIMP interfaces. Windows, icons, mouse, pointer, static. It doesn't matter whether you're using GNOME or whether you're using Windows, macOS, it's the basic same sort of thing. Well, what's happening in 3.0? We can see that today with the use of the iPhone, multi-touch surfaces, like the multi-touch controller developed at the Cbase. Things that are much more natural and direct, but much more chaotic. There are many different types and styles and rules and methods of implementing a multi-touch interface, But all you have to do is put your hands on the glass, and within 30 seconds to a minute, even somebody who's not very technically savvy can get a grasp and learn how to control the computer and how to do things and how things play. The iPad is a perfect example of this. I saw Tim Pritlove's son playing games. You know, he was barely verbal, but he had a complete understanding. Thank you so much. Can you give him a round of applause for bringing me coffee? Like, you gotta... okay. Not quite Dan Kaminsky animated yet, but hopefully we'll get there. And multi-touch is a perfect example of a 3.0 style interface. Less centralized, direct, much more natural. You know, instead of having to do keyboard macros and use a mouse to point at things, you have people engaging directly with the interface. But not all multi-touch interfaces work exactly the same way. A lot, they have many different gestures, many different ways of interacting. Another example of a 3.0 interface, Project Natal, the full body gaming control being developed by Microsoft for the Xbox. 3.0 interfaces are going to take many different types and many different forms, but they're going to involve much more full body, natural interaction than we saw with the 2.0 interfaces, the first graphical style WIMP ones. And then the augmented reality applications. Things like Foursquare are not quite at that stage yet, but we've seen a lot of different products and a lot of different science being developed into augmented reality applications. And those are going to take on many different forms. There aren't going to be very standardized, one product, one vendor sorts of things. They're going to take on many different kinds of applications, and people are going to customize and use what they like. The standards for interoperating among those augmented reality applications are going to be very similar, I think. But well, I guess if we give the other guy, we got to give Oki a round of applause for bringing me coffee, too. Thank you. But even though the augmented reality applications are going to take many different forms, they're going to be able to interoperate. Even though you and your friend are using completely different programs, completely different interfaces with augmented reality, you're going to be able to interoperate because of open standards being developed in those fields. Moving right along to communication. Communication, and this is a much more broader thing, you know, I've gone from web to interfaces to communication as a whole, just to show you that my theory for 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 can hold regardless of the overview and the height of the overview that you're taking. 1.0 communication, word of mouth, putting messages on horseback, simple, direct, crude, natural. Communications 2.0, we start seeing centralized telephone networks. We start seeing centralized national postal networks. Massive adaptation, massive growth, but not quite refined, a little bit more refined than 1.0, but still not at a sustainable, flattened, natural thing. Communication 3.0, internet everywhere. I know it seems like we can't wait for it to get here, but eventually it will get here. Eventually, in the hallmark of first world societies will be internet absolutely everywhere. From what I briefly know about Japan, it's almost this way there. That virus says that there's mass adaptation of WiMAX in Japan. Japan's always led the way in those kinds of communications networks. We're going to get there. A lot of hackers are doing great work in building mesh GSM networks. Can you imagine a cell phone network that doesn't require as many antennas? That's one of the big things that's preventing more comprehensive cellular service. I'm pretty sure it's this way in Germany, but I know it's this way in the United States. Just having to put up ugly towers that people are afraid that are going to give them brain cancer is one of the reasons why we have such spotty service in a lot of different areas. Can you imagine cell networks working without the need for those, that your phone is providing service to the phones around it, and so on and so forth? We're seeing implementations of that today, but we're not quite there yet, but I think that that kind of telecommunications infrastructure is the future. Distributed channels, and we're going to see much greater adoption of massively multi-party peer-to-peer technologies. You know, the mesh GSM and mesh internet networks are an example of that, but things like BitTorrent are, and those styles of communications where you have many peers connecting to each other, like chat roulette, or the thing that you guys have been working on, which actually I probably shouldn't talk about, are going to be the hallmarks of communication 3.0. I think this theory also holds with culture. In my examples there, entertainment. Entertainment 1.0, you have direct performances, troops going from one place to another, theaters, people telling stories to each other around a campfire. This is entertainment 1.0. What happens with the Industrial Revolution? We get mass entertainment. You find big broadcast distribution networks looking for one piece of content, taking that piece of content, extracting that, and trying to market it towards a mass audience. This is what the post-war era was all about, what records were all about, what radio was all about, what TV was all about, and you know what movies are all about. You spend and invest a lot of time and energy in developing this one thing that you can sell to as many people as possible. Well, what's the future of entertainment? And we're seeing this a lot today. Big example of this is self-publishing. You know, even 5, 6, 10 years ago, it would be nearly impossible for one person with one work to be able to reach millions of people. Today, it's commonplace. A person can publish their own novel, they can publish their own recording, they can publish their own TV, and through these sort of the communications channels that we described before, reach a mass audience and know how to market to that mass audience. And this even goes beyond the internet. You see bands and groups touring, making friends, spreading through word of mouth networks, things that very closely resemble what was going on in 1.0, only for a mass global market. I think the further we get, iTunes is definitely a 2.0 technology. It's centralized, it's big, it's mass adoption. The 3.0 version of that is, I feel, going to be a massive global media library. We're going to have one directory of all of this content, just like, you know, iTunes is a standardized directory of all this content. But instead of being centralized in the hands of one player, it's going to be a reference to all of the millions of libraries of content that are out there. They're going to learn how to share, learn how to combine, learn how to become part of one catalog that people can easily access, like they easily access iTunes today. But instead of it being controlled by one source, being controlled by the interconnected web. Things that are powering entertainment 3.0, direct consumer-to-artist payments. You know, even with the iTunes store, you still have a middleman there taking their cut. When you pay 99 cents for a song, the artist will get 45 to 50 cents of that. Where does that other money go? It goes into bandwidth costs and licensing costs and DRM and bad technologies and making profit for Apple, all things like that. The closer we get towards entertainment 3.0, you're going to see of that 99 cents that you pay for that song or you pay for that book or you pay for that article or whatever, the person who produced that content is going to get 97 to 98 cents of that. And as more artists start gaining more and more from their work, they're going to be licensing it a lot more freely. One of the direct reasons for maintaining copyright laws is so that producers of content can get compensated for their works. Problem is, a lot of that compensation goes to the middle parties that are doing the marketing. As artists and producers of content start getting paid much more for their work, they're going to see an enlightened self-interest in getting that work out to as many people as possible so that they can collect more for their work. And the only way they can do that in a system, in a 3.0 system, is to license much more liberally, allow people to make copies of it, to just say, I know there are people out there who will pay for me to continue producing this content. I don't need to hold it hostage with DRM in order to make a living off of what I'm doing. I think this also is a great analogy for food. And one thing that I have to say, as I'm moving into these examples, I'm making one critical assumption, which I think I addressed in a slide. I believe that the current carbon-based transport network, where we have goods and services from all over the world being shipped to us, is unsustainable. And I think a lot of 3.0, when it comes to physical goods and things like that, is going to be driven by more localized production. And this works in food. When we saw the beginning of domesticated agriculture, we saw local domestication, local production, local consumption. The grain that you were eating in, you know, the 9th and 10th centuries was grown within 20 kilometers of where you live. Today, Of the carbohydrates that we eat, they could be grown anywhere from 1 kilometer to 100, 10,000 kilometers away because of the nature of the transport networks and the things that put together our food. And in a way, that's good. We can get a lot of products, goods, and services that would be out of season. We can have a local producer that ties together raw materials for food from all over. But, you know, there are obviously nutritional and other downsides to that. As the global transport network, as it becomes much more expensive to actually bring all of those goods from all around the world into your market, we're going to start seeing a mass return to more locally grown, locally sourced, locally sustainable sources of foods. And we're seeing a lot of this today. It's a niche market, but I think it's a bellwether for the future. Things like urban farming, farm shares and farm collectives, the recapture of suburban areas. There's a lot of good arable land around major metropolitan areas. I know it's much more common here in Germany to have broad areas of green space between areas of civilization, but in a lot of other places in the Western world, you see unrestrained growth. You just see continued parking lots, roads, development, turning forests into grass outside of major urban centers. The future is going to see, and we're seeing it a little bit today, a retraction of that expansion of cities. People are going to become much more adept at living in much more population-concentrated areas so that that land that are around major urban centers can be used for the production of food, for growing more green spaces, and for doing the sorts of things that will be food 3.0. This also applies to sex, I think, the 3.0 pattern. 1.0, you know, back in the day, you know, sort of pre-civilization, you had many partners. Survival of the fittest. It's very crude, it's very direct, it's very natural, and decentralized. Sex 2.0, sort of the civilized era. You see in any major civilization, you see a focus on things like monogamy, marriage. You find your one partner, and they are your one partner for the rest of your life. And when you're looking at civilization in the pre-industrial era, these kinds of social constructs were necessary for holding societies together. You know, you couldn't have the sort of competition cycles among civilizations that were characterized by sex 1.0 and maintain order and discipline, raising of children, cohesion, and those sorts of things. But I think we're in a modern world today where we're seeing a return to the kind of 1.0 sex characteristics. You see open polyamory. People who acknowledge that I have a life partner, I have somebody that I make my home with, somebody that I'm planning on having children with, but people who are openly acknowledging that, you know, I still want to seek physical sexual pleasure with other people. And couples that do that, you know, sex, the quote-unquote sex-positive people, are living in what I would think is a sex 3.0 world. But this only works when you think of things like emotional monogamy, you know, where you say that, yes, I'm going to have sex with other people, but I'm going to remain emotionally committed to my quote-unquote main partner. Sometimes these sorts of things don't work out, and people move from somebody that they've been with for 10 years, maybe had a child with, to somebody else that they'll be with for 10 years and had a child with, yet to somebody else that they'll be with probably until they, you know, die or so on and so forth, and perhaps have more children with. Remarriages, second and third marriages are not tremendously uncommon. I think this is a sex 3.0 phenomenon. And before, in this sort of sex 2.0, less sex positive world, you didn't have an open exploration of fetishes, of certain things that might have been taboo before. But now it's not uncommon for people to discuss that just like they would discuss music, art, or other things. Of course, the mores vary throughout the world, but I think those kinds of things are part of what I would term as sex 3.0 and are a part of this natural 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 progression. And of course, my favorite topic, being an accountant, commerce. Manufacturing, 1.0. Local raw materials, local finished goods. You have just locally produced food, but at the same time, shoes would probably be made from leather from cows that were slaughtered within 1 to 10 kilometers of where the cobbler was. 2.0. You see, in the post-industrial world and in the post-war era, long, 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 long value chains raw materials from anywhere, going to the places of lowest cost production. The reason China is exploding is because they're the lowest point, or the lowest cost point of production for many technical things. Even though circuit boards, computers, and everything can be designed anywhere, they're made in China because it's the cheapest place to make things in mass. Manufacturing 3.0, moving away from that sort of centralization to points of lowest cost production, are going to be things where we can still take raw materials from many different places, but we're going to keep recycling those raw materials locally, and we're going to keep producing, and we're going to start producing things much more locally. The MakerBot is a perfect example of this. I made the characterization last year between the MakerBot and the Altair 8800. Yes, it's a crude production device, but it's a sign of things to come. 5-10 years from now, you will be making things that you would have to go to the store and buy inside your house. You're going to have the raw materials to do that, and you're going to have the printers and the resources to directly print things from your computer. It's a project started by hackers that's going to change the planet. Another thing you're starting to see is the local recycling of raw materials. You're going to start seeing a better mass adaptation of raw materials like aluminum, which you can just keep recycling and recycling and recycling again. You know, this is where I think Germany and the European Union on the whole are pioneering. You don't see in average places a spot for recycling and separating out materials and goods that you see here in Germany. And that's a hallmark of manufacturing 3.0, the ability to keep, preserve, and retain all of these raw materials to make things from. At the same time, and even though this is a more Chinese phenomenon, you're going to see open manufacturing. You're not going to see big players paying a lot of people to preserve their intellectual art to develop something that they keep in secret and patent. You're going to see major industrial players shrink a little bit, just like we're seeing automotive companies in the United States shrink. And what they're going to do is they're going to start sharing their designs openly. One company will take one design, innovate a little bit, and share it with other companies inside their network. This is referred to as Shanzai, and if you have an opportunity, you can Google Tom Igo and look for his article on Shanzai, which completely blew my mind. And the final thing, which I like to call the Lego effect, a lot of the components, just like we see in PC construction, we're going to see a greater push towards standardization of components so that you can take things that make up one thing. One part will break from it, but you can still take the 9 other parts in that and apply it to some other use and make other things like that. To take an example of this, the MakerBot uses a standard ATX supply. If you manage to plug in a 110 ATX power supply that makes poof magic green smoke, you can cannibalize a PC, pull it right out of that, put it in your MakerBot, and keep going. 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 also holds for money. Before we had currency, we had local value exchange. A farmer would trade a sack of grain for a chicken. Then we see that, you know, that's obviously not sustainable. It's not characterized by, you know, sorts of high growth. It's things that only work in a very local area. So what do? You have currency, stored pockets of wealth. Started with gold, and now we have things like the dollar and the euro and fiat currency, which are really meaningless. They're just coupons saying that at some point somebody gave me something, or I gave somebody something that was worth what I believe 10 euros is worth, and I'm going to buy something that cost 10 euros. That's just a temporary store of value. That's all money is. In a 3.0 money world, when we realize that that currencies and stored value mechanisms, which are very, very easily manipulated, are going to begin to fail. And people are going to realize that, look, we have the technology to go back to that 1.0 direct exchange of value and start building trust-based value networks to replace things like cash and to replace things like bank transfers. You're going to see things like service invoicing, where you provide a service to one person who will later provide you a service, and so on and so forth and on through an interconnected network. I think these sorts of things are going to happen. We're probably not going to see them in our lifetimes. Our grandchildren might see them, but it's really a concept. Money is already a very difficult concept to grasp. But I think as the unsustainability of cash itself comes into play, and as people start realizing that cash and currencies controlled by transnational organizations as a way of preserving power, are not sustainable. People are going to start taking things back, and technologies are going to be developed that allow people to directly exchange value without having an intermediary between them. Interoperable obligations are an example of this, sort of going back to the service invoicing, but on a massive market, where perhaps you've provided perhaps you provided 2 hours of services to a person, and in exchange for that, you got 4 hours of services from them. Well, instead of taking that 4 hours of service from them, you can go into a market, trade those 4 hours of services for goods and services from other people who want to buy services from the person who you've provided services towards. And we're going to go back to sorts of cash accounting mechanisms. Right now, most accounting exists on accrual. People extend temporary credit to their customers, and people get temporary credit from vendors for the receipts of these services. It's called accrual accounting. It's a way of, I mean, that's a very, very crude example of accrual accounting. But instead of those sorts of theoretical, we can make up the numbers as we go along, styles of accounting, we're going to go back to directly provable transactional accounting that we currently call cash accounting, when we go back to the sorts of things in Money 3.0 that I described. And finally, services, to lead on not so complicated and theoretical as an example as money, but services 1.0, local, like I said, 2.0, outsourcing. You see the importation of labor through immigration. Here it's Turkish people coming to clean floors and do very menial work. In the United States, it's people from Mexico, from Latin America, traditionally Spanish-speaking people, that the jobs that you know we think are dirty or don't want to do, we're bringing people in to do. And at the same time, things that can be outsourced, like call centers, are again being shipped to the lowest cost and lowest point of production. Services 3.0, I think, will be characterized by letting people focus on building the skills in what they intrinsically and naturally do best, and taking all of the things that can be automated and all of the jobs that can be scripted and letting those things get automated. Right now, we're really bad at taking things that are really automatic, sort of cron job-like structures. And Johannes pointed this out in his presentation last night on FAIL. We're not so comfortable in automating these things. 3.0 services will start seeing people being much more comfortable at automating things like accounting, at automating things like transport, at automating different things, which right now we're afraid to sort of completely let go of. At the same time, you're going to see the end of the entities that are too big to fail. You're going to start seeing companies that are big and massive and can only provide those services because they're so massive being replaced by networks of more independent agents that have standard protocols for dealing and talking to each other. I'm perhaps dating myself a little bit here, but in the era of CompuServe, in the era of AOL, a lot of people thought a system like the internet that we know of today would be impossible. How do you get people to share with your network, and why would you ever agree to carry traffic for a person that you don't even know? Well, it's happening today. Just like we saw that a massively distributed network communicating on standard protocols with communications, we're going to start seeing those same sorts of things with services, where people like accountants who need somebody to go reconcile accounts on the other side of the planet automatically through trust-based networks trust somebody that perhaps they've never even met and perhaps never will meet to do that work for them, and to have other people that they know vouch for that person's work and make that as a part of an audit. Those sorts of things are impossible, and those are reasons why we have big, massive global accounting firms today. And at the same time, you're going to see people who, instead of running a coffee shop but also managing the books and picking things up, focus on doing what they do best. If a person owns and runs a coffee shop, they're going to spend a vast majority of their time figuring out how to make better coffee, figuring out how to make the environment in their work better, communicating with customers, and spending much less time on that business overhead. The sort of overhead that takes away a lot of entrepreneurial skill and a lot of entrepreneurial energy is going to be outsourced and locally sourced to people who are much more adept and skilled at doing that. And with that, well, I got through those examples pretty quick. That's pretty much the end of my presentation, but I'm going to leave this sort of Gantt chart up here. And so now it's, I guess, time for questions. And I don't have... Are you guys cool with passing around the microphone? Okay, cool. Then I'll start over here. And then just pass it to the person, next person near you, the question.
I just like to point out an analytical issue that's, if we talk about the
actually, I'll trade you.
We've still got a world in which the...
Could you start your question over for the people who might not have heard it? Okay.
This same problem exists when you talk about the industrial and the information revolution, but we've still got a world in which the vast majority have not are not a part of the information revolution. We've still got a world in which a large amount of people have not even experienced industrial revolution yet. They still live in an agrarian existence. So I just want to know if, A, you would think these 1, 2, and 3 will exist at the same time, there'll be pockets of 1, 2, and 3, and B, how you see society that's not yet integrated into neither the information nor the industrial revolution participating in 3.0 in any way?
That's an awesome question. I'm glad you brought that up. I think you're going to see a lot of these, and again, we have to look at civilizations and groups of people that are interested in development. A lot of time when we talk about things like the Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations, and we talk about bringing all of these technologies to the rest of the world, we have to acknowledge and we have to realize that there are peoples on the planet that don't want development, that view it as a threat. And I believe that we have to respect the decisions of those people throughout the world who don't want to become a part of the modern era. That aside, what we're seeing, especially with cellular networks in places like Bangladesh, in places like Africa, is that they're just going and skipping the 2.0 intermediate step. They're going directly from 1.0 to 3.0. They're not developing massively centralized networks or organizations. But you're seeing a lot of people who perhaps have had educational experiences or have traveled abroad and are bringing those kind of decentralized networks and 3.0 technologies and implementing them directly, because they're much more easy to ramp up than the 2.0 style technologies. It's not perfect, and I think that there is still a long way to go, but on the aggregate, when we see development in the third world, and when we see more and greater capacity building in a lot of these areas, it's what I think is going to be a direct jump from 1.0 to 3.0 and skipping the 2.0 intermediate step. Of all of the people on the world who have mobile phones today, for example, the vast majority of people who are currently carrying cellular phones have no idea or concept of what a landline is. I was actually talking with somebody here in Germany who's was sort of teaching German to their child and using a traditional sort of picture and word way of doing it. And so mom pointed at a telephone, which was the standard classical icon of a desk handset. The child had no idea what it was because the child had never seen a landline handset. You know, their parents gave up their landline a long time ago. And you have to acknowledge that the kids who are being born today probably will have no concept of that. You know, the things like payphones will seem as antiquated and outdated as police and fire call boxes perhaps might be to us. And those are sorts of backup and evidence for what I think is going to be a 1.0 to 3.0 direct jump. Next question, I guess we have to pass back the microphone. Frank, did you have a question? Oh, is this the same question? Okay. Gee, I hope that wasn't the only one.
You mentioned with the side track the centralized networks and from the user's side, the internet is the mostly centralized network you can imagine. What about these ideas concerning the BürgerNets, which was set up by WOW Holland? These user-driven internets consisting of little wireless devices. Do you have an idea how to fit in this concept?
I think the pattern holds. I'm not going to say that we're completely away from decentralization, but the only way we're going to get to completely user-based networks are when average users have the capacity to do so. And it's a generational thing. You know, now we're seeing, I mean, the kids being born today were born to parents who may have been born into computers. And it takes that kind of generational skip until we see people who are really born, who are intrinsically born, who have been raised from birth around these technologies as if they've always been there. Once we have that generation that finds it very, very hard to imagine other things, you're going to see the capacity for those kind of networks. Once that's there, once people sort of were born with it and are intrinsic with it, it's going to take a little while to adopt those sorts of user-based networks. But I think we're sort of seeing that today. Of course, the problem with that is that we're still living in a largely 2.0 world. People don't feel the need to do that. People are being more or less seduced by massive centralized networks. Facebook, I think, is a good example of this. Why would you go and start your own social network, or why would you start developing your own sorts of things when all of your friends are on Facebook, when all of the people are on these big centralized sorts of things? As those big centralized things begin to break down, and people decide to replace them with more decentralized things, you're going to see, I think, a much greater concentration of these user-style wireless networks of people pooling resources and sharing things and connecting and interoperating among themselves. You know, a wireless, for example, is a relatively new phenomenon. It's something that we've seen grow and begin in our lifetimes. But our children are going to grow up in a world where wireless is just supposed to be everywhere. And they're going to begin demanding it in areas that it's not, and they're going to begin building these sorts of networks because it's what they have to do. That if you, as people are starting out and they need internet in their houses, they're going to go to their neighbors and they're going to start sharing things, and they're going to start learning that. And they're going to pass those values on to their children who are going to continue to build on those sorts of things. I mean, obviously, this is a very utopic worldview and perfect in me thinking that all is, you know, love, happy, shiny, lolcat kittens. You guys are awake a little bit. But it's what I have hope for and what I think will happen on a smaller scale. I don't know if that even answers your question, but...
Yeah, that fits the question, of course.
Okay, thank you.
Let me thank you for this glimpse of a better future on the horizon in this upcoming age of dark we face in the internet at the moment.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, I always find it weird to give this sort of hopeful, the future will be fine and this is what's going to happen in the future talks, when we're sort of staring down the abyss of apocalypse. You know, in the Cold War, we were sort of staring down the abyss of a nuclear apocalypse. Now we're staring down the abyss of a sovereign debt apocalypse. You know, we thought only nuclear missiles can end the world. Now we can see, you know, our massive government debts will probably somehow find a way of ending the world. But discounting all of that, I think that it's one way of framing developments. I've been largely positive with this. In these examples. And I guess one quick caveat, and I hope somebody pressures me on this point, is that these things can also be very negative, and that the same kind of development patterns, I intentionally did not discuss politics because I wanted to keep it positive, but if you apply the same pattern to other different things, you can see where a lot of these things are destructive, where you take away perhaps centralized control that are provided by governments and law and republics, and say that, you know, perhaps government 3.0 might go back to sort of a return to fiefdom, which we're beginning to see in some areas. As a lot of areas demand much more local control, you see greater incidences of xenophobia and greater incidences of the tyranny of the majority. And that I think that a pattern will only hold when it's good when you can see it in positive and negative terms. But I, of course, to keep everything light and hopeful and, you know, happy, shiny, smiley guy in suit, didn't look at that. But I think you can take the pattern and extrapolate it that way. And since it's 1:45, I think I have time for just one more question. Do you have a... Oh, could you pass the microphone back to Frank? Was there anybody that had a really burning question that they really, really wanted to ask? Okay, so I guess, Frank, quick question for you, and then we'll take the gentleman back there if I'm not missing anybody.
Yeah. If I listen to your talk, it's like everything is in a 2.0 world at this moment. Can you think of of areas where we're still either in 1.0 or we're already advanced to 3.0?
I mean, I think we can see the 3.0 world today, and remember, it's because this is a method or a pattern of looking at what's going to happen in the future. In a way, anytime you apply this pattern, you're making the assumption that you're in a 2.0 world. That perhaps if all of the technologies that I think of might happen in a 3.0 world, again, they'll think of everything that came before what's immediately in the present as the 1.0 distant past, everything that's now in the 2.0 and 3.0, because I think the aggregate trends in anything like that are cyclical. You know, you're going to get, in following the cyclical order of the law of entropy, you're going to get from incredibly disordered system, move into a system that has more order, and then the system itself, once it reaches a critical mass, will begin to tend back towards disorder. And you just see that cycle and pattern move over and over again. And perhaps that's one failing of the theory that I've come up with right here. But if anything, I'd say that going back to that example of the third world, and that the telecommunications networks of the third world are 3.0 networks. You could also argue they're 1.0 networks because they're very crude and they're just beginning to ramp up. But I would say that that's an example of a 3.0 world, that we're living in. And then the final question back there. Yep.
Thank you. Dirk Krause, Pixel Park here. I think you're completely right about children won't have any problems shifting towards 3.0 economy or something, but as a businessman, I really suffer from people who still are stuck in the 1.0s or even 0.90 era. So do you think that if you were challenged to create a slide that showed education one, which probably is grandfather passing to father, passing to son or daughters, and education two, like classical school system, what would be education 3.0?
Education 3.0, I think, would be, again, returning to 1.0. Instead of sending your children to one school where, like in France, you have every school child in a grade is opening up the same textbook all over France, you're going to see a return to, and we're seeing this a little bit today, of parents being much more engaged in the education of their children. And instead of just farming their kid off to a teacher who they trust will teach them things, are going to be more critically analyzing what those children are learning. And perhaps instead of sending their child to one school a day, are going to send their child to perhaps an outdoor, more kindergarten-like center in the morning, have them go to a traditional classroom setting in the afternoon, and then spend time with a tutor who might teach them a different skill. Instead of leaving children in school for 8 hours a day, we're going to see children moving along a day much like you would see an independent contractor in order to build those kinds of capacities. And we're seeing this a little bit. There's a return to homeschooling in the United States where parents will stay at home and teach their children. And it's not just there's a classroom in the house and they're, like a teacher teaching to a child of one. No, it's an experiential sort of thing where they're taking their child to museums. They're taking their child to various different trips. They're intentionally exposing their children to certain things and to certain values that they share in. And the 3.0 educational system, like I said, will be characterized by parental involvement and a much more conscious effort to teach more individualized curriculum and provide individualized experiences to children. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Great. It was awesome talking, guys. I loved SIGINT. This was really awesome. Me and the other hackers on a plane are off to Poland now. I just want to thank you guys again and give you a round of applause for being so great. Thank you.